I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today on Smart City, we're talking about the past and the present. This month, Fast Company magazine named Chicago its U.S. City of the Year, and when they needed someone to capture the messy vitality of the city, they turned to Alex Kotlowitz. Alex is a journalist and author of the book, Never a City So Real. We'll talk about what makes Chicago the U.S. City of the Year and how the city's troubled past will affect its future. We'll also speak with Emily Wadhams. She's the Vice President of Public Policy for the National Trust for Historic Preservation in Washington. She says that preserving and retrofitting historic buildings with new technology can be more environmentally friendly than building new buildings. That's today on Smart City, right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. When Fast Company magazine named Chicago its U.S. City of the Year, they asked Alex Kotlowitz to write a profile of his adopted home. A former New Yorker, Alex is an author and journalist who now makes his home in Chicago. His work includes the book There Are No Children Here, which tells the story of two boys growing up in housing projects, and Never a City So Real, an exploration of Chicago through the eyes of its residents. Smart City producer Scotty Iseri met with Alex at one of the author's favorite locations in the city, the Garfield Park Conservatory.
Alex Kotlowitz, thanks for being on Smart City today.
Well, thanks for having me.
So you've written this article for Fast Company magazine that names Chicago the U.S. City of the Year. What does that mean exactly?
Well, you know, I think of this city, and you can find all the contradictions and all the paradoxes in this country within the boundaries of the city, you know, whether it's race or class or religion or money. And for me, it's America's city. I mean, you come here to sort of understand this country. I mean, I remember maybe 6 months ago, I got a phone call from an Italian producer. They're doing a six-part documentary series on Chicago, and I asked them, why Chicago? And he said simply, we want to understand America. And it's certainly why I came here, you know, 25 years ago, was I thought it'd be a great perch from which to sort of understand this country's soul. And so you find the best and the worst about this country. I mean, that which we feel incredibly proud about and that which really embarrasses us. I mean, you find it just in this neighborhood that we're in now. We're in Garfield Park on the west side of Chicago, which is part of the Black Belt of the city. Very impoverished community, hardscrabble, rough home, very poor neighborhood. And it's one that struggled, and it struggled before the Martin Luther King riots, and has particularly struggled after that. But it's also a community that's got this incredible vitality to it. We're sitting here now in the Garfield Park Conservatory, which sits smack in the middle of the neighborhood. It's 100 years old. It's this, you know, cavernous 4.5 acres of tropical plants and foliage under one roof. I mean, a place that people not only from around the city come, but people from all over the world come to visit. And you've also got right next to it Garfield Park itself, which is this exquisite piece of landscape. But you go to either side of the park and you understand the entrenched poverty in this country. And so you see all the contradictions just within these few blocks that we're in here.
Chicago is known for its neighborhoods. And I'm wondering, how do neighborhoods contribute to the sense of vitality in a city individually and as a whole?
Well, you know, the city's always been thought of as this kind of very parochial place. I mean, you ask somebody where they're from in Chicago, and they'll usually tell you their parish if they're Catholic. And if they don't tell you their parish, they'll tell you their neighborhood. I mean, I think there are something like 120 neighborhoods. In fact, Rand McNally put out a map that divided the city up into all the neighborhoods. And I, who am not a native Chicago, could tell you that they even missed some. And each of the neighborhoods have their own sense of identity, their own sense of place. And even on the west side, which is predominantly African American, you can go from Garfield Park to Austin and find a very different personality and character to that community. For me, what I love about the city is you go around all these neighborhoods and it's the restaurants in these neighborhoods. I mean, you go in there and they're kind of like a portal onto these communities, and you can find every kind of food. In fact, just around the corner from where we're at now is Edna's, which is one of the best soul food restaurants in the city. And Edna's has been around for some 50 years. She served the workers who were here with Martin Luther King Jr. in the 1960s. And while all of Madison Street burned, her store didn't burn because I think the people in the community so respected who she was. And if I had one piece of advice to anybody coming to this city, is I would just say, get out and walk and just go out and have lunch, and you'll inevitably find your way into these corners of the city that you otherwise would never have reason to explore.
I've seen you described as an accidental Chicagoan. What does that mean exactly?
Well, I'm from New York originally, and I came here because I thought, well, this would be a good place to sort of report on this country, right in the center. It's America's city, and I thought I'd be here 2 or 3 years. I've now been here some 25 years and counting, and so I sort of ended up staying here by accident. It wasn't a purposeful move that I'd made, and I think Chicago has that. It has that lure. It brings people in. It's also a place, sadly, that a lot of people move on from, usually to New York. I've got a friend, Tony Fitzpatrick. I don't know if you're familiar with his artwork. He does these exquisite pieces on the city. He grew up here, and he's always talked about this city as having this kind of exotic quality, like Mumbai or Paris. And I think he's right. There is something exotic about this place. I mean, people don't think of Chicago as an exotic city. But, like, I mean, for instance, I go down to the very far south side where the old steel mills were. And boy, the architecture of that place is incredible. And by the architecture, I'm not talking about Frank Lloyd Wright or Louis Sullivan. I'm talking about the geometry of these steel mills that, at one point were the center of America's industrial strength and power. And you can see what was and, sadly, what is. There's an exotic quality about that corner of the city. You walk here or along Madison Street, where you have people selling stuff outside and people just milling about. Again, there's this kind of exotic quality about the city. And I don't think people think of Chicago that way. I mean, they think of it as very gritty and hard. But there is something about this place that I don't think you'll find anywhere else in this country. And it's also this city that I've always thought is a city that kind of welcomes outsiders. And I've always, for one whatever reason, I've always thought of myself as an outsider. But when you think about this city, it's where Frank Lloyd Wright and Louis Sullivan, changed the face of American architecture. They didn't do it in Boston or New York. They did it in Chicago because there was nobody to tell them to do it any differently. Montgomery Ward's and Sears Roebuck, they started their catalogs and changed the face of rural America here. Jane Addams and Saul Alinsky, they changed the way we view the impoverished. And so it's always been this place that in some ways has been a welcoming place for outsiders.
There's a lot of cities right now that are looking to attract creatives and innovators, and they might fall into that outsider category. I'm wondering if you could speak to what Chicago does that can attract these people.
Let me tell you that the city itself is pretty inventive. And it all is also, the other thing that's wonderful about this place is a city that's constantly reinventing itself, constantly changing. One of my favorite stories, we're sitting right in the heart of it. This place was in disrepair in the early 90s, and the windows were cracked, the plumbing wasn't working, the tropical plants were all dying, and they decided they were going to rebuild it. And now they get 500,000 visitors here a year. But at the same time, it was really part of Mayor Daley's efforts to try to prettify the city. He planted all these trees all over, 500,000 trees eventually. And they realized, in some ways by accident, that there was a real purpose to what they were doing. And so it led to what we now know as the greening of Chicago, where they're making it a really environmentally friendly city. And it's really looked at by other cities as to how we can transform our cities. And, we've got 80 acres, I think it's 80 acres of rooftop gardens now that really do an immense amount to cool the city. They are going through all the alleys. One of the particular things about Chicago has got all these alleys. And so they're going through all the alleys and putting in a permeable ground so that the water will now drain back into Lake Michigan so that the water can be recycled. So the city itself is pretty inventive. It's not the only city that does that, but it is a city that has always tolerated outsiders, more so than I think other places. I always think, people think of Chicago as kind of a parochial place, but I think about my hometown, New York, as parochial. I mean, you go to New York, if I were living there, there's no question my circle of friends would be other writers and journalists. I'm in Chicago, I just feel my life is so rich here. You know, I've got friends who are steel workers, I've got friends who live here on the West Side, former drug dealers, I've got, you know, friends who are also artists and writers, and it's just this incredible mix, and I think that's what I love about this place.
Do you think Chicago has a willingness to, or even a propensity towards risk?
Well, yeah, it's a city that's always been willing to take risks. I mean, and it's a city also that doesn't know enough not to take risks. I mean, I think of the story, you know, turning, you know, back in the turn of the last century when they had the Chicago River was all feeding into Lake Michigan, all the sewage was going in there, and they had the gumption to try to and successfully turn that river around, and so it flows the other way, so the sewage all flew out of the city and not into Lake Michigan. So it's a city that hasn't known enough to say no.
You start out by talking about the history of Chicago, and you speak to a historian, and what is it about Chicago's past that can inform or does inform its future innovations?
I mean, this is a city, what I admire about it, that sort of recognizes its past. I mean, it doesn't always. I mean, it's got somewhat, like many places, troubled relationship with its past, but it's there, and I do think that it's constantly finding a way into the present. And again, I think of where we're sitting here now, the Garfield Park Conservatory. You know, it's 100 years old, and the person who designed this was Jens Jensen, this great, renowned landscape architect, and the people around his time, Hay and Burnham, all believe that the city should be built around parks, that everybody should be able to be within walking distance of parks. And so you see that sensibility about the environment, about the outdoors, about the ecology today as well. And so you see how the past sort of very much influences the present.
You spoke a little bit about your conflicted feelings about Chicago. And I wonder if you could just elaborate on that a little bit. What are your conflicted feelings about Chicago?
Well, look, it's a city that's got an incredibly ugly history when it comes to race. I mean, that for me, I mean, it was all kind of, you look at the campaign of Harold Washington here, you know, the city's first black mayor. You know, on the one hand, there was a great deal to celebrate. I mean, here was this black man who was running for mayor, had this incredible coalition of blacks and whites and Latinos. On the other hand, it was a campaign that was so ugly. In fact, his opponent, you know, his slogan was, "Before it's too late." There was nothing subtle about what was taking place there. When Harold Washington was elected, you know, the 29 white aldermen all opposed everything that Harold Washington introduced because they couldn't stand the idea of a black man running their city. So there you see it right in that. On the one hand, this great deal to celebrate. On the other, this great deal to bemoan. And so you look at the history of race in the city, the entrenched poverty, and you look at the intersection of money and the pollution of money in politics in Chicago. So I think there's a lot to be distressed about in a place like Chicago, as there is elsewhere around the country, but there's also a lot to celebrate.
Are you continually distressed, or do you see hope?
Oh, you know, I kind of probably an eternal, I know this may be hard to believe, but kind of an eternal optimist. And given what I do, writing, I mean, the very act of writing is an act of hope. So, yeah, I'm always hopeful. I mean, look at the presidential election now. We have a Chicagoan who may not only be the next president, but may be the first African-American president in this nation's history. And that, for me, is a great deal to celebrate.
So what do you think Chicago's future looks like? Looking ahead, what do you see?
There's a lot going right about the city. I mean, you look at the core of the city, it's beautiful. I think it's one of the, if not the handsomest cities in this country. And yet you sort of begin to make your way out from the core of the city to where we are, for instance. And you can see the distress. You know, we're heading to some really, I think, difficult economic times. I think it's going to make it harder. So I don't know. I think a lot will be sort of how the city tries to wrestle with this growing sense of inequality that's not only here in Chicago but around the country. And Chicago may be a good kind of a test tube for how we wrestle with that. You look at the demolition of public housing in this city. You know, public housing in Chicago became sort of the national metaphor for our disregard, if not outright hostility, towards the poor. And there's not a person I know who set foot in public housing and wouldn't tell you, if they were being honest, that, look, it should have all come down. So in some ways, we've done the right thing. You know, we've torn down all these public housing high-rises. But, of course, the question is then, where's everybody gone? What have we done to improve people's lives? And I'm afraid not, at the moment, not much. And I do think other cities are really looking at Chicago to see the success or a lack of success of the demolition of public housing. I mean, that for me signifies is a very historic moment in how we sort of deal with the disenfranchised, with the poor. And I'm not quite sure yet what to make of what's happened. I mean, I think we'll know in a few years. But people have been moved out to the outskirts of the cities. And I'm afraid what's going to happen is we may end up replicating what's happened in Western Europe, where the very poor kind of circle the city like a wreath. And if that ends up happening, I think it'll be not to the benefit of the city.
But at the same time, you do see a lot more people coming in to the city from the suburbs.
Right. Well, you see a great deal of gentrification in the city. And look, the one thing you can point to that's if not going right, but I think the effort is right, is the efforts to reform the schools. And part of that, you know, to be crass, was to try to bring middle-class families back into the city. And they've been successful at doing that. As any parent will tell you, I mean, one of the first priorities they have when they decide where to live is to find a place that's has good schools. And I don't want to be too cynical about it, because I don't think it's the only reason to reform a school system. I mean, the problem, and really what the schools here are wrestling with, is in communities like the one we're sitting in, is these schools are not functioning. You know, half or more than half the students in this high school right across the street, Flowers, are dropouts, and we can't tolerate that. I mean, schools have long been seen as sort of the transcendent force in this country. It's sort of how people get a leg up, and they have not lived up to that by any means. And in fact, if anything, have been somewhat of a destructive force in people's lives. You go to a school that's not functioning right, and I think you begin to sort of give up any sense of hope, any sense of ambition, any sense of aspiration. And I think reform schools, improve schools are absolutely vital, not only to bringing middle-class families in, but also to improving the lives of those like in the community we're sitting in. And I think it's important. I mean, you've got to have a city that's vital in its economy, and you can't do that if you don't have some mixture of families. So you're right. I mean, people are moving back into the city. And that, yeah, again, you look at that center of the city, and man, it's beautiful. I mean, look at Millennium Park. You don't get much more beautiful than that. I mean, that place is spectacular. And talk about gumption. You know, there we had this open, you know, 40 acres that was of railroad track. And we decided, well, why don't we just build a platform, 40-acre platform over that, and build a park on top of these railroads, and not only build a park, but build this incredibly exquisite, magical band shell. You know, I was just in Baltimore not long ago, and at somebody's house, and they had a book about Millennium Park. I mean, I think it's what other cities are looking to try to do in their own towns. There's a realness about this place. I mean, it's just really, it's a city that's where it's the people here are grounded. And you're right, you go out to L.A. and, you know, let's say you're making films, you know, you think, well, maybe I should go and I need to meet some construction worker or meet an inner city kid. And in Chicago, I don't think you can live here without sort of stumbling on people of different ilks and finding your way into their lives. I can't imagine living in the city and not being able to do that. And again, New York, on the one hand, everybody's living on top of each other. So you go out on the streets of New York and you see that diversity. But I do think that actually people lead pretty constrained and parochial lives in New York.
I was thinking about something you said in the article where the people are the soul of the city. Does that mean that the kind of innovation and creativity that you see in Chicago or in Seattle or the other places that were mentioned, does that make it hard to replicate that? If a city wants to grow and become successful, do they look to their people?
In the end, if you don't have those people, you've got to figure out a way to attract them. And so I think Chicago's been able to grow them here itself. Ultimately, what makes up a city is not its architecture and not its infrastructure, but it's the people there. And for me, it's an incredibly rich city. I just think about the West Side. I think, again, there's another restaurant not very far from here, MacArthur's, a soul food restaurant run by this guy, Alexander MacArthur, and Everybody calls him Mac, but he's one of these guys who just believes that people should have a second chance in life. And so all the people he hires are not all, but most of the people he hires are people who've had troubled lives. You know, people coming out of prison, people who are recovering drug addicts. And some of them make it and some of them don't. And it's also some of the best food in the city. And so it's people like that that for me just really sort of give the city its vitality and its health.
I know this has been kind of a love letter to Chicago. I don't know if there's any other cities you want to send a shout out to, any other cities that you visit or that you have lived in that you feel are also doing something right.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, I think you could go around the country and look at cities that are doing something right. I'm from New York, and New York is always thinks of itself as the center of the universe, and it is, you know, but also New York is sui generis. I mean, there's really no place like it. But if I had to pick an American city, and I have, to live in, it'd be Chicago.
Excellent. Well, thanks for being our guest on Smart City today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Alex Kotlowitz is the author of the books There Are No Children Here and Never a City So Real. He recently profiled Chicago in Fast Company magazine, which named the city its U.S. City of the Year. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us each week from Planetizen assistant editor, Nate Berg.
Getting drivers to slow down is a difficult task for many cities. They often try regulating fast and dangerous drivers with traffic cops, but logistics limit the ability of a few cops to catch every speeder in the act. So cities go passive. They build speed bumps and other traffic calming methods to physically slow people down. But many complain that the bumps damage cars and delay emergency response vehicles. So the city of Philadelphia is experimenting with a new way to slow traffic, through optical illusions. They've painted images on the street that appear to approaching drivers as three-dimensional bumps. City officials hope the optical trickery will cause drivers to slow down. The Telegraph reports that they're currently testing this method out at 100 different places throughout the city. Data will be collected from the effort to see if more cars are slowing down and causing fewer accidents because of these virtual bumps. Meanwhile, in Houston, public transit could be taking a major stride forward in the next few years. The City Council recently approved an agreement with the Metropolitan Transit Authority to expand the city's light rail system. The Houston Chronicle reports that the council voted 13-2 to grant the Transit Authority the right to build 5 more lines into the city's system. Metro officials say they can have all 5 lines completed by 2012. Many in the city are excited about the prospect of expanding their system, but with no guarantee of federal funding and a lawsuit challenging one of the line's proposed layouts, the approved 5-line expansion is not a done deal yet. And finally, in Southern California, transportation planners have been foiled again. In an effort to reduce traffic in the notoriously congested region, more traffic has been created. Transportation officials just completed a much-needed extension of a San Bernardino freeway last year, making a connection between 2 busy freeways. The San Bernardino Sun reports that the freeway connection has caused a huge jump in traffic. Recently released data shows traffic between the two freeways has increased upwards of 10, 15, and 20% at peak hours of the day, creating a heavily congested section of freeway from what was intended to speed people's travels. Demand in this case has responded to the increase in supply, and now planners are looking to catch up with the demand that has surpassed the capacity their freeway expansion provided. They're now planning to widen the freeway, but those further expansions are not expected to happen for years. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor for Planetizen.com. Coming up after the break, we'll speak with Emily Wadhams. She's the Vice President of Public Policy for the National Trust for Historic Preservation. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Emily Wadhams is the Vice President of Public Policy for the National Trust for Historic Preservation. The Trust is a membership organization dedicated to saving irreplaceable and historic buildings and spaces, but these days the Trust is also focusing on something they call sustainable preservation.
Emily, the National Trust for Historic Preservation claims that preservation has an essential role to play in combating climate change. Make that case for me.
You've probably heard the expression that the greenest building is one that's already built. And we like to say the greenest building is one that's never built. And we think with all the focus on climate change and global warming and greening buildings that there's an essential component that's missing. And that's the buildings that already exist. There's very little focus on reusing existing buildings or reinvesting in existing communities. And we think of buildings as a renewable resource. I mean, we recycle papers, bottles, glass jars. Why not recycle buildings? And it really hasn't been part of the dialogue in the climate change issue. It's been more on how we build new buildings. How green are they? How do we build new communities that are green? And how do we change our daily practices? So the National Trust for Historic Preservation is really interested in having the discussion about reusing existing buildings, older and historic buildings, as we continue looking for solutions.
Well, I love you for it because what you're saying makes a lot of sense. But you know and I know that many older buildings they leak. They are not always the best insulated. How are you thinking about preserving older buildings and yet bringing them up to better standards for energy savings?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to point out that older buildings were often built of more durable materials. These materials are going to last longer. They have a longer life cycle, especially buildings built before World War II. Materials tended to be better quality. And so those buildings are going to be around and can be retrofitted or made more energy efficient. So also older buildings have in them something we called embodied energy. It took a lot of energy to make those buildings, to construct them, to use the materials to construct them, and then to operate them over the years. So you don't want to throw that energy away. And people think that that doesn't really matter if we talk about future energy use. But if you demolish or ignore an older building and go ahead and build a new green building, the studies that we've looked at says that it'll take you something like 40 to 65 years to recover that energy you just threw away in that building or ignored by not reusing it. So no matter how green the new building is that you're constructing, our proposition is it's better to reuse that building that you already have and make it more energy efficient. The General Services Administration did a study that showed buildings built before 1920 are more energy efficient than any buildings built since, except in the last couple of years. We've gotten smarter in the last couple of years and are building buildings that are a little more energy efficient.
Well, that's good news.
Yeah. So our point is older buildings may not be completely energy efficient, but they can be retrofitted. And that's often because they've been neglected and maybe the windows have gotten leaky or the doors have gotten leaky. But those things can be remedied using a lot more energy in fixing them than leaving them there and letting them continue to leak air, for example.
Emily, let me make sure I understand your 40 to 65 years to recover the energy used in older buildings if you tear them down and build anew. I assume what we're talking about there would be the energy that was used to make the materials and then put the building together.
And then operate it.
And then operate
it.
Okay. That one's confusing to me. Why do you put in the operating number?
Well, because it takes energy to operate a building over its life. So you don't want to throw away the energy you've already expended on that building. You've already used energy on that building. So don't just assume that you can throw that away and start over. There's a cost to doing that in our mind.
Let me ask you about LEED ND, the LEED Neighborhood Development, which of course is the new classification being used now to evaluate neighborhoods. But it seems primarily new neighborhoods for LEED certification. So tell me, do you think preservation is appropriately valued in the LEED ND formula?
Well, we really got into this whole sort of sustainable development and climate change issue at the National Trust for Historic Preservation because of what we saw happening with the U.S. Green Building Council's LEED rating system. And we felt that the reuse of existing buildings and historic buildings were not weighed properly in their rating criteria, that they were not considering them as they were figuring out which buildings should get LEED certified and which buildings would be considered green. We think reusing historic buildings or older buildings is as green as it gets, and we felt that the U.S. Green Building Council LEED rating system should reflect that. So that's really what got us started on this a few years ago.
Have they made changes since then?
They have committed to making changes and have begun to make changes, which we're very pleased to know. And we are actually have been asked to work closely with them as they review their rating systems and make changes to weigh reuse of existing materials and location of buildings in their calculations. And they are starting to do this and have acknowledged that the rating system does not give enough benefit for the reuse of buildings.
So they've acknowledged it, but they've not yet worked it into their rating system.
They are currently, right now, as we speak, beginning to revise a rating system and are releasing a new rating system for people to evaluate and comment on this summer. And we will be commenting on that and working with them as they revise the system.
Part of the system they're addressing, are they addressing simply the LEED building ratings, or are they also addressing LEED ND, which, of course, is much newer?
They're looking at it across the board. LEED ND is a good first step because they are looking at the bigger picture and the building in context of where it's located. But they are going to be doing it across the rating systems for every LEED rating system.
Does LEED ND, you may not know enough of the details, I certainly don't, but I was thinking about vehicle miles traveled, which seems to me to be sort of one of the best location evaluation measures for the greenness or the sustainable quality of any building or any development. Is that something that you have urged them to use?
Yes. Well, we've urged them to look at location and primarily, you know, do you have to get in your car to go somewhere to use that building? For instance, you can have the greenest big box store in the world, but if it's located out at an interchange and everybody has to drive there to shop there, we don't think that should be considered green. And LEED is beginning to incorporate those changes into its rating system now and did take that consideration into consideration in LEED ND as well. But that brings up another point I'd love to make while we're having this conversation. You were talking about transportation, and carbon emissions in the United States from transportation accounts for approximately 32%. That's all forms of transportation, air transportation, car, truck travel, train travel. That's 32%, whereas buildings, the operation of buildings, accounts for 43% of carbon emissions. That doesn't even include constructing new buildings. That's just the operation of the buildings that are currently out there. And that's why we think this is a really important issue to bring to the attention of people, that most of the focus on policy at the federal, state, and local levels has been on reducing the amount of vehicle miles traveled and carbon from forms of transportation. But 43% of the carbon emissions in this country comes from the operation of buildings. So to neglect the existing built environment in looking for ways to address climate change and global warming is to neglect a big factor, a big carbon factor in this picture.
Let me shift gears a little bit and talk to you about preservation. And I know you've seen too, some pretty bruising preservation battles, some of which I thought were absolutely worth fighting, and others where I thought the preservationists were simply anti-everything or surely anti-anything new or modern. How do you know, Emily, where the balance is between what should be preserved and when something new should be built? I mean, does the National Trust always advocate for preservation?
That's a really interesting question, and it's a debate that we have within the preservation community all the time amongst ourselves. I mean, what is worth preserving and, you know, what are the societal benefits of preserving that? And it's interesting because the regulatory framework, you know, the rules and regulations that sort of that drive preservation really are about looking at a balance of public needs. And preservation is one of those needs that needs to be thought of when you're doing some sort of a major federal project, for example, building a new highway or planning some urban renewal in a neighborhood or some sort of community revitalization. You should be weighing and evaluating what you might lose if you lose those historic buildings. And you need to take that into consideration in the debate. And for a long time, before the National Historic Preservation Act was passed, for example, in 1966, they weren't considering the impact on historic resources and on that community. What happens if you lose those buildings or that neighborhood? And now that's built into the process. So it's not a law that says you must save all old historic buildings. It really says let's, as a community, decide what is important to us, what places matter, and what we lose if we lose them. So it's not an easy either-or. It really is a discussion.
What are some of the factors that weigh in that discussion?
Well, economic benefits, for example, are one thing you really want to look at. You know, should you be saving these buildings because they have future economic potential? And if you revitalize a building or a neighborhood, that's going to create jobs. It's going to be an economic engine for that community. Should you reuse those buildings to create that economic activity, or should there be some other sort of economic activity, for example? And also the significance of the buildings. What's the story they tell? How important are they to our history or that community's history, and should they be lost? What does the community care about this resource? Do they think it's valuable to them? And if they lose it, is it going to leave a big hole in their community and sort of change the quality of their community, the sense of identity of that community?
I know over the years the trust has moved from simply preserving buildings to really helping communities think about how to reuse those buildings in an economically viable way. I mean, what role now does the National Trust play in trying to help communities think through new economic potential for old buildings?
Well, the National Trust, you know, works with a network of preservation organizations and Main Street organizations and other organizations around the country. So we try to help them do their work in their communities. There's no way we, as a national organization, could do it all ourselves. So our whole focus is on empowering them and giving them the tools and the capacity to do the work out in their own communities. But when it comes to historic building that may have outlived its useful life, there are so many incredible, wonderful examples of buildings from the scale of the Dia Beacon north of New York City that was a huge sawtooth roof industrial building that I think was vacant and abandoned and sitting there and has been turned into an incredible art space. To a small building in a community, you know, a commercial building where the store has gone out of business and they've left, and what do you do with that space? And, you know, somebody comes in and decides to open up a restaurant in a space that was once a department store. These buildings are renewable and reusable and adaptable in ways that, you know, a lot of people may not consider. And the fact that they have stood there perhaps for 100 years means they can stand there for another 100 years, which brings us back to the whole recycling of buildings and that they should not be ignored or walked away from because they've outlived their useful life.
Well, there are two categories of buildings that I want to ask you about. I know they're both on the priority list of the trust. The first are these magnificent churches. Here in Chicago, many of them are Catholic churches that have either lost their congregations or downsized them severely. You'd be losing a very important neighborhood landmark to lose these buildings, and yet clearly their use has changed fairly dramatically. How are you helping communities think through how they save these churches and yet save these churches without those congregations to support them?
Well, it's true of churches. It's true of a lot of other public buildings as well, libraries, post offices, courthouses, where they've maybe outgrown their use or the population has diminished and they don't need them anymore. So when buildings like churches, post offices, courthouses no longer serve their original function, we try to help people around the country find good examples of where people have solved that problem and share that with other people as widely as we possibly can. So a lot of what we do is put people in touch with other people. This is what happened in Boston with the churches there, and so maybe that will help in the situation in Chicago, for example. And all buildings can be reused in one way or another. You know, maybe a church, I think there are examples of churches that have been turned into museums, for example. Not church museums, but just the spaces are wonderful spaces. So they're wonderful exhibit spaces. So you can keep that building, still tell the history of your community through that building, but then have an entirely new use for it. So we try to connect people with other people that have done that.
You've also made chain drugstores one of your top issues. Tell me why.
Chain drugstores were a problem because they were often coming into the downtowns and communities, which you think would be a good thing because we want our drugstores in downtowns of our communities. But their solution was, we have to tear down a building that's here now and build a new building that will have drive-up, pharmacy window, parking in the front so people can easily access our store. We were very concerned about that because of the impact that they were having on downtowns, because the first solution often was to demolish historic buildings to put a brand new building in that community. And often a building that was a suburban building model, not in more urban or downtown building model. So a big focus for several years was to really work with some of the chain drugstores to get them to think about other ways, other models of building those stores or using existing buildings in downtowns.
And how were you able to help them meet their customers' needs and at the same time do an urban store, not a suburban or, you know, a neighborhood center type store?
People often overestimate the need for parking in some of these communities, and they think, you know, if you have lots and lots of surface parking, you're going to have a successful community. The last thing you really want are a lot of blank holes in your community. So I think often these businesses think, okay, people are going to be driving, we need to have a car for each customer. But if they're parking on the street or around behind the building, and then they're doing their drugstore stop, and they go to the post office, and they may go to another store or city hall or the library while they're doing that, they need to really look at how people are going to act once they get to that downtown and use that store. So I think what we found, especially in our Main Street program that the National Trust, the National Main Street Center runs, is to get people to think a little bit about how people function in those communities. And do you really need as many parking spaces right smack in front of your front door as you think you do? Especially when you think of a suburban shopping mall, people assume it's convenient, but they may be parking quite far away from the actual store because those parking lots tend to be vast. So it's just rethinking about how people expect the customer is going to act and saying, you know, this, think about functioning downtown a little bit differently than in a suburban situation.
What do you do about the drive-up window? I've always wondered, I mean, they put pharmacies typically in the very back of the store, so I guess there's retail strategy there where you're going to walk through everything else and wait while you're getting your prescription and maybe buy something else. But since they do provide the convenience of drive-through in suburban models, I wonder if, you know, maybe they should put a window at the front of the store so that you never have to go in.
Well, that might be a good solution. We'll suggest that. But, you know, think of banks, too. Banks are the same way as pharmacies. And they're in a wonderful situation where banks have figured out how to have people have easy access to either drive up or walk up to automatic teller machines. And the same with pharmacies. There are good solutions. It's not one size fits all, and what we try to do working with our network of preservation organizations across the country is point out those good solutions and also take a stand when we feel an important historic resource is going to be lost. Really help the community if they feel they want to save that resource and have that dialogue with whoever is developing that new project. And, you know, so we try to work from soup to nuts, give them the capacity to do the work in their communities or help them with that capacity, help them with grants if they need a grant to work on a particular building, all the way through to legal staff at the National Trust that can help them look at their legal options.
And one more question, Emily, are there other public policy issues currently at stake for the National Trust, things that are very high on your priority list?
Well, our highest priority right now is getting incentives to rehab buildings for community revitalization. And that can be from this, you know, environmental perspective, that it makes environmental sense to save these buildings, or from the social or economic perspective. And we can, you know, we can talk about it in all those ways. It has all of those benefits. But our top priority is really giving people the tools and incentives to reuse those buildings and reinvest in communities. And that can be through historic tax credits to the state level, to helping local communities enact policies at the local level that will help them incorporate existing buildings into their whole sort of energy efficiency plans. Just about every community across the country right now is looking at how can they be greener, how can they be more energy efficient. They're looking at their building codes, they're looking at their energy codes, they're looking at their zoning and ordinances. And so top policy priority for us is to work with those communities to help them incorporate reusing existing buildings and reinvesting in those communities into those policies. We're getting calls from all over the country for help with this. We're planning to work with cities like Seattle and Mayor Nichols there, who has asked us to help them as they revise their energy code to make sure existing buildings aren't left out of the equation and they're made more energy efficient and also considered as a green option.
Well, Emily, I appreciate the work you do at the National Trust. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you very much for having me.
Emily Wadhams is the Vice President of Public Policy for the National Trust for Historic Preservation. This week, City View's commentator Walker Smith is thinking about character. He says that while situations may shift, one's true character should always shine through.
It is often said that a person's true character is what he or she will do when they think that nobody is watching. Perhaps that's correct, but I'm not so sure. Maybe what people do when they think no one is watching has more to do with the situation itself than their true character. I don't mean to make excuses for people, but we shouldn't ignore the power of context to shape our behaviors and guide our actions. Regardless of what we think or believe, sometimes the situation overwhelms our best intentions or, thankfully, suppresses our worst impulses. Indeed, there is no such thing as a situation-free action. Acting alone is as much a situationally bound behavior as being influenced by the crowd. If we are sweet and gentle to our families in private, yet overbearing and rude when we are trying to show off our mettle to others in public, that doesn't mean that we are truly sweet and gentle. Because truly, when we are mean to our families, even if it's only in public, what we do is hurtful to them and reflects a part of our character that is definitely true of us in certain situations. It is more accurate to observe that a person's true character is a stew of many things, and what it takes to get character right is the right combination of ingredients. If we expect citizens to give back to their communities, or corporations to care about social responsibilities, or soldiers to fight within the rules of war, or athletes to resist the temptations of performance-enhancing drugs, then we have to do more than rely upon individual consciences. Sometimes the situations in which people find themselves are too powerful for them. They need the nurture of the right situation. There's a lot of research in social psychology that demonstrates the power of social influences to trump personality or attitudes as influences on our behaviors. It is important for us to build and put ourselves into the right kinds of situations. When we neglect our communities, we create situations that free people from the many social pressures that often keep them away from antisocial behaviors. We can put all the blame on others, but as much as that might be the proper way to look at it, we mustn't overlook what we need to do about situations. We should be creating supportive communities that minimize whatever negative role that situations might play. Lots of us grew up with our mothers telling us that we are the company we keep. This was their way of teaching us to be careful about the situations in which we put ourselves. It's too easy to be at the wrong place at the wrong time and then wonder why, in retrospect, we couldn't help ourselves. After all, we say to ourselves, if no one was looking, we wouldn't have done that. The problem is that someone was looking, and that situation overrode our best intentions. We didn't need more moral character. We just didn't need to be there. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his latest book is Generation Ageless. We want to hear from you. You can contact us through our website. Just head over to smartcityradio.com and click the contact button. While you're there, you can listen to archive shows, sign up for our weekly newsletter, or subscribe to our podcast. Got a question about anything you heard on the show? Send us an email at questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Scotty Iceri is our producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.